First, let me emphasize again, Mr. Chairman, that we've asked the legislature to abolish these as separate divisions and create a single department. You know, those divisions no longer exist, and except for the expenditure limitation, it would be a real true merger. But let's say we have a major increase requested from a comp carrier. The thing that you probably want to do if you were the director is you probably wouldn't want to wait 6 weeks or however long it might be and go to the e-board and argue about taking some people out of the comp program, you know, who are ordinarily assigned there, and having them use their expertise on that insurance regulation matter.
You wouldn't have to do that. That is ridiculous. The only time you get into trouble is if you had spent a whole bunch of money in one of the divisions and then used up the limitation, and that is not going to happen within the space of 6 weeks. And it's not going to, nothing in keeping track of the money is going to affect how you assign your personnel and who works on what. We just sort of want to be able to keep track of how the money's spent. Pure and simple. We have objections to Senator Wire's motion. Hearing none. Carries. 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Now, do we just move all of LFO report so we can get this budget out of here? Or do you want to set it aside?
Mr. Chairman, what we have ready for you is some look at the actual expenditures in each one of the program areas. And you probably aren't going to have the pieces that you need from workers' comp and the discussion out of the committee until at least midweek. So Monday, Tuesday, we could Tuesday. Continue with this discussion if you'd like it at that point.
Yes, yeah, Monday we want to deal with the health stuff.
Right. Tuesday then we can go into the actual expenditures by division and then we'll pick up the pieces for the other from the other committee towards the latter part of the week.
Mr. Jones.
Tuesday be the last day.
Mr. Chairman, it'd be the last day on those parts that you can take some action on now. You have to defer to your other committee.
Mr. Chairman, Gary, Tuesday be the last day.
Yes, sir. I think Tuesday will be the last day. I think we can.
Okay. So y'all have a nice weekend. And Monday at 1 o'clock. The House is going into session at 3, so the subs have been moved up to 1.
What are we going to work on Monday?
Health. Rural hospitals and health planning.
Gibbies?
No.
Certificate of need.
A little minor stuff. Be okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're adjourned.
Public safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee meeting, May 25th, 1987. 1:30 p.m., room H174.
Subcommittee on Public Safety and Hospitals will come to order. I'll ask Art to pass out some -8 amendments to Senate Bill 343, for which I open a work session. Now, what Senate Bill 343 does is to eliminate the State Health Planning Development Agency as a separate agency and places it in the office of the Director of the Department of Human Resources and calls it an Office of Health Policy. The bill is amended by the Senate Committee, reduced and simplified required reports to the state from hospital and other healthcare facilities. And they also established a mechanism to exempt rural hospitals from certificate of need. And they then clarified the state's focus of certificate of need on those projects that may result in excessive and unneeded health care costs. That's how it came to this subcommittee. The -8 amendments before you are amendments that I and my staff worked on in cooperation with the Oregon Hospital Association, and after that work was completed, discussed with the State Health Planning Development Agency's director in terms of budget impacts. The first part, lines 2 through 4 of the -8 amendments, eliminate a rather large report, the hospital measurement system, and that would translate into the reduction of one FTE within the State Health Plan Development Agency's budget. Then on the next number on line 5 and 6 of the amendments, change the cap on hospital facility expansion from $1 million to $2 million and change the other part of that exemption from $250,000 to $500,000. That would have some impact, but would not probably change the number of certificate of needs that would be reviewed from the biennial estimate of 30. Quite a reduction from where we are at present, but not where we are for the original or for the amended budget impact. Then lines 9 through 13, go back and pick up those outpatient facilities who had taken advantage of a window between sine die and the effective date of health planning laws last session and make sure that those don't all of a sudden show up in inpatient facilities or used for inpatients, contrary to the intent of the 1985 legislature. Then the other amendments further streamline the reporting. And then finally, on the line 17 and 18, as well as on line 19, are technical errors that were made or were left in 343 as they left the Senate, picked them up, clarifying that the duties are transferred to Director of Human Resources. And as it was originally proposed, CN would have stayed with the Health Division, and somehow Health Division got left on page 21, and we took it out. So that's what they do. My understanding is that the Hospital Association can live with them, and that members of this subcommittee find them acceptable, though subacute care is an issue that some wanted inserted in the statute, but I understand a budget note asking the Health Council to study that would satisfy those concerns. Representative Jones.
That particular issue is that the ambulatory part of that that you're speaking of with the sunset on
that I didn't speak to, but will next. There is some concern about ambulatory surgical centers and the desire to remove them from a certificate of need. I'd be prepared, and I think the people I've been talking to, and this includes leadership and some people over the weekend, it's been busy, have indicated to me that it sunsetted in 2 years. Would be acceptable to most everyone except for Oregon Eye Associates. They had a certificate of need denied by the State Health Planning Development Agency. It went to a hearings officer who recommended a reversal, and then it went to the Court of Appeals who upheld SHPTA's original denial. It is not known at this time whether the Supreme Court would review it or not. We took an opportunity this morning to meet with the proponents of Oregon Eye Associates who wanted a quicker exemption. I listened very carefully to their arguments, which got into personal remarks and charges about another physician in the Eugene area and about the major hospital in Eugene. And the more I listened, the more I felt uncomfortable that the legislature deal with this. It just doesn't seem appropriate for the legislature to get into that kind of a local fight, nor does it seem appropriate for a very narrow group, he one client, to try to circumvent the judicial branch. So that's the background. I think if Senator Hannon would like to move the Dash 8 amendments, then I'd go ahead and move that amendment that you had mentioned. So Senator Hannon.
So I just Hannon, so move.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hannon moves that Senate Bill 343 be further amended by the Dash 8 amendments. Objections to that motion, hearing none, so ordered. The chair would move that ambulatory surgical centers be exempted from certificate of need on July the 1st, 1989. Objections? objections to that motion? Hearing
you mean it takes effect in 89, or it would be sunsetted in 89 now?
Be exempted. The ambulatory surgical centers be exempted from after any certificate of need process effective July 1, 1989. So that's a sunset in 2 years. If you don't do that, what you've done...
Right.
Meaning that the sunset then would do away with the regulations we have today and start in the
That's correct.
That's
that would keep
to your window. That's what you're talking about.
In that case, what's called a level playing field until that date. But if you start exempting ambulatory surgical centers now and you leave $1 million on for hospitals, then you have a situation where an ambulatory surgical center can go and put equipment of $1 million in, hospitals can't. And the point is to keep that level, but to say that there's considerable interest in the legislature in going ahead and eliminating the surgery centers in 2 years.
And that would provide the whatever necessary for them to do the July 1 of 89 if they want to take another look at it and then do whatever they
do. Yeah, this would sunset. It would take then positive action by the legislature to continue ambulatory surgery centers after July of 89.
Whatever they want to do.
So are we clear on the chair's motion?
That's right. But it does stay in effect, though.
But it stays in effect until July of 89.
And then they have to get a certificate of need?
For ambulatory surgical centers.
Yeah, that's the part that I want to make sure that I understood.
Right.
Just like it is.
For the next 2 years, they'll be required to get a CM and then it's sunsetting.
Because if we don't do that, we give the hospital problems, don't we?
I think they wanted a level playing field.
That's what they want.
I mean, the hospitals, you know, let's give them a little problem. Mr. Patterson's had it too good with this bill so far. No, I'll support it.
Okay. Hearing no objection to the chair's motion, it carries.
Where's that?
We'll find the place.
Okay.
There's probably in definitions.
Okay.
Or we may have to add a section.
Sure.
That's done. Then we'll have budget report language that there should be a study on subacute care, either conducted by the Oregon Health Council or by the entity that they feel is appropriate to conduct it. There. Now we have a real, lean, focused CN program with almost all the interests except for Oregon Eye Associates addressed. So we're consensus except for that one entity. Then we can move to the budget and ask Mr. Simmons, is Janice Yadens here? Would you like to come up with Mr. Simmons or? Okay.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Dan Simmons, the acting director of the Department of Human Resources. And I think what Art is distributing to you is a work paper that Wayne Wolf, who is with me today, he's the assistant director in charge of the Office of Program Review, developed in conjunction with your staff and in conjunction with the State Health Planning Agency people, Dick Grant and others, to define for you the costs associated with certain functions as we understand them that are now being performed by the State Health Planning Administration. And those on that paper are arrayed in descending order of priority, starting with the most important from our perspective, I suspect, and then going down the list. And the target was, as I understood it, was $250,000. And what we've done is arrayed those in a fashion that we can deliver those functions within the constraints established by the subcommittee.
Now, a question has come up, and it relates to another bill that we have before Senate Bill 428. And know that Ms. Hayden has some comments about it too. The concern is that there maybe aren't enough staff in the Office of Rural Health to always carry out all of the functions in 428. And the question I would have to you is, does the department view the Office of Health policy as an entity along with the Office of Rural Health so that staff could be assigned to work on rural health problems if there was a shortfall and it would be seen as a unit?
Right, Mr. Chairman, that'd be one of the things that I would ask from the subcommittee, is to give us the flexibility. You know, we've worked on these in conjunction with, as I mentioned, the staff of the State Health Planning Administration. After they're within the Office of the Director and integrated, there may be a need for movement one way or the other. So to answer your question, I'm sure that that could be accommodated.
Reverend Jones.
Dan, where's this $250,000 as compared to 1985-87 expenditures for this, more or less the same?
I can't answer that, Mr. Chairman. Wayne?
Is this new? Is this new general fund money? And the FTEs are new, eight of those? That's what I want to know.
The agency had requested 22 positions for 87-89.
Are new?
No, that would have been total. That would have been total positions.
But I'm wondering,
is the
250 new when we get all the shuffling done?
The 250 is new to the governor's recommended budget, yes. The governor did not have the general fund supporting this at all. So that is new general funds.
But it's not for a new effort.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at.
The effort was at a higher level in the current biennium than it would be in the next biennium, and it had federal support at that time.
This is back down.
Mr. Chairman, the estimate in the governor's printed budget was a general fund expenditure of $747,000, which included a few more functions, a couple functions that aren't on this sheet. But with the funding in those functions, it would still be, I think, about a couple hundred thousand less than was in 85-87.
Even general fund.
I'll have to remind.
I understand that. Ms. Jaden.
We think it's a good bill. I wasn't prepared beyond that. We're anxious to have the health policy unit set up in the director's office. I think that will be a unit that will offer a lot of background information and data that will be able to provide the legislature next time some overall picture of the health care system, rather than having individual bills coming at you in little pieces. That'll answer a lot of questions to the system of health care.
Art, looked at the budget?
I have looked at it. The funding sources on that are pretty clear. It's made up of about four parts. One's $250,000 of general fund we've talked about. Secondly, about 175,000 other funds that comes from the Adult and Family Services Division for the need that they have to administer the Medicaid law. And then the rest of it will come from fees, licensing fees and certificate of need fees that are contained in Senate Bill 343, which would support the balance of the budget. So those three sources then would make up the total budget.
Okay.
That level of position seems to be required to carry out the provisions of Senate Bill 343 as you amended it with your -8 amendments. And yeah, like you had indicated, the certificate of need fees are based on about 30 CNs being applied for during next biennium, and that's the revenue source, or that's the basis of the estimate.
Mr. Chairman, aren't you furnish us with an explanation of where these funds were, where they come from, and when we get it all together on the floor, we're going to have to depend $250,000 here in one place and a reduction in another, or a transfer from some other place.
No reduction, Mr. Chairman. The governor did not recommend the certificate of need program other than funded by fees.
But it was, that was in some place though in 85, 87, according to Wayne. There's some place in art, that's my point, is, you know, if you ship these around and replace them, that's fine. But when you're talking about losing money, then you got to justify that up on the floor, or you get it back down.
You need to know that $250,000 of general fund is beyond the governor's budget. The governor deleted...
My question there, was it in the program someplace before the governor made his budget?
Yeah, it was an existing level,
what
but he used the savings for other programs in 87-9.
That's fine, I just want to know.
We'll show you a comparative chart of what shift it was before Senate Bill 343 and the governor's recommended and what's after. We can show you the comparisons.
I would point out that the general funds are really not for the certificate of need function. It still primarily is funded by other funds, as shown on the second page. There's only a little bit of general funds, and that's to back up the functions in case that the fees don't come in at the full. You'd be about a lot of $300,000.
You understand what?
And actually, you're talking about where the $250,000 came from.
Yeah, come out of some other program that, even though it wasn't in the governor's recommended budget, it was someplace back.
What had happened? Governor had zeroed out the State Health Planning Development Agency, but the governor had never intended to do away with the health care cost review functions. And as we went through this statute, we costed out what did it take to fund the statutes, and these are still current law. The money came from savings in the governor's budget that we've accumulated.
Chairman, we'll give you one other comparison, perhaps, Representative Jones, and that is that the by the time that you transfer everything, all the remnants from State Health Planning to the Director's Office, the total general fund budget would be $553,000. And that compares with the number that Wayne Wolf just gave you, $747,000 in the current biennium.
Sure.
That's a reduction of $194,000 and 5 FTE.
Okay. That's good. Okay, so that's the way you'd look at it. It's like you look at other budgets, present biennium to last biennium, we'd find $199,000 savings in general fund and 5 FTE. Okay, good. Then the chair would move that Senate Bill 343 be amended to carry the appropriation as described and presented by the Department of Human Resources.
Objections? Mr. Chairman, second. Along with the budget bill.
Along with the
discussion.
Objections to that motion? So ordered. So budget notes, we've got subacute care. We have flexibility within the Office of Health Policy to help out and assist the Office of Rural Health. Would there be that kind of flexibility granted?
Don, are you getting those budget notes?
Was there any other budget notes that were needed? Can't think of any. Okay, good. Then, Mr. Peer.
What are you doing,
Chairman,
way back there?
I have the budget notes in connection with the subacute care, flexibility, and so forth. I'm unclear as to your intent in the budget note narrative of what, in terms of the ambulatory surgical center.
That's an amendment to the bill.
That was an amendment to the bill.
And that's...
Don't need in the... And the budget,
budget report.
And you understand it's the Office of Health Policy that is going to include the Office of Rural Health, and we want to give the department as much opportunity as we can within that unit. We're okay on that? Then Senator Hannon moves Senate Bill 343 as amended by the subcommittee to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 428. And then Janice Yaden wanted to say something about it.
I feel like I should be watching economic development. Actually, Hirsch and I were coming up as a pair.
Okay, good. Senate Bill 428 relates to rural hospitals. Senator Timms wants to call. No.
We finished that up.
It's a bill that, well, solves a lot of problems for rural hospitals, but also gives them a different rate of reimbursement.
That was what I wanted. Mr. Chairman, my name is Janice Jaden. I'm Assistant to the Governor for Human Resources. And the concern that I had not realized until Friday that this bill actually had passed out, giving rural hospitals a different rate of reimbursement under Medicaid than other hospitals. And the concern that I wanted to raise was whether or not that was really the direction we wanted to go in state policy. And I felt since we are going to have an Office of Health Policy and Rural Health coming up this next biennium, that it would make more sense to take a look at that, if that is really the policy direction we want to go. I know that Hirsch has some cost figures on that, and I'm less concerned about the cost because it appears to not be a really large cost, but I am concerned about setting that as a precedent without a lot of discussion and thought going into that, of whether or not we want to, in fact, use this as a vehicle to subsidize rural hospitals in any way, and whether or not we ought to be looking at some of the other problems that the hospitals have under the Medicaid reimbursement at the same time. And I personally would prefer to see this go as a study during the interim than to set up that as a precedent at this point.
Okay. Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Hirsch Crawford, and I'm the acting Medicaid director. Presently, AFS uses a DRG type, or Diagnosis Related Group type reimbursement system, to reimburse all hospitals under Medicaid in the state. Under that DRG system, each admission to the hospital is classified into one of 473 different categories, or DRGs, with each DRG being assigned a different relative weight. Currently, the relative weighting scale ranges from 0.2 to 12.3. And that relative weight is designed to represent the difference in cost to the facility to treat a patient with that particular condition. Reimbursement under our system is determined by multiplying the relative weight for a particular admission times our standard unit value, which is presently $1,748, and that reimbursement rate is standard across all hospitals that participate in the Medicaid program. We do make additional pass-through reimbursements for capital expenditures and medical education expenditures, and with the exception of those two pass-through payments, all hospitals are reimbursed the same amount under our Medicaid program for treating a patient with a particular condition. What Senate Bill 428 would do is for Type A rural hospitals, which we have presently identified as there being seven hospitals in that category, it would require that the Medicaid program reimburse those facilities at 100% of billed charges for both inpatient and outpatient services that are provided by those facilities. We have looked back at 12 months worth of billings from those seven hospitals, and we have determined that the cost of reimbursing those facilities at full bill charges for both inpatient and outpatient care for an 18-month period during the 87-89 biennium would be $838,000 in total funds and $372,000 in general funds. Now, we have priced that for an 18-month period because we've assumed that the bill would be effective as of October the 1st, and then we have allowed for a three-month billing lag. So we would actually start making payments at that higher reimbursement rate of probably effective around the 1st of January. So we have priced it for an 18-month period.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to that, we have some concern that the HCFA, or the Medicaid agency, would approve this change to our reimbursement system. We have attempted to talk with them over the phone and to determine what their concerns are, and basically at this point they're not willing to give us a final answer. They are concerned that we basically don't violate the Medicaid reimbursement provision that requires that we not pay more than Medicare would have paid for a particular admission in one of these facilities.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, what's considered a referral center?
Representative Jones, that would be a facility which is capable of treating more complex cases, and patients would initially be stabilized at one of these rural hospitals, and then if their condition were too serious to be treated there, they would then be transferred to a referral hospital.
Is that the reason, more sophisticated equipment? Or?
Yes, sir. One other comment I would like to make is before we went to our DRG type reimbursement system, which we did in October of 1985, we had a flat rate reimbursement system which did pay each hospital in the state a different rate for an admission. It was the reimbursement amount was just determined on the basis of the fact that an admission had occurred at that facility. We paid the same for every admission, but each hospital had a different rate depending upon what its cost structure was.
Would that buy you with OP care?
Hirsch and I would have to do some calculation on that. I'm not sure how significant of an impact that would have.
Are you talking about a multi-million dollar budget?
We had talked in our budget hearings about the cost of increasing OB fees by 50%.
And you were in several million when you did that, right?
Two.
1 million two.
Which is six times more than what we're talking about here. See, what this bill, you know, the way I'm beginning to look at the bill is that it has some policy statements and some promises to go to work on salvaging rural hospitals through some networking. Then it says to the state, well, at least state, don't you be the cause of us going out of business. It's saying, state, at least you pay our costs. That's what how I read this policy. And you're not saying these seven are going to close tomorrow. So you're saying in order to get us out of this crisis, at least help the state push us into it by paying us our costs. Okay. I think that's reasonable. If the subcommittee could go along with that. Okay. So then I would say, why not give the inpatient and the outpatient at the cost, and so to amend Senator Hannon moves that Senate Bill 428 be amended to provide for reimbursement at cost, and that's understood to be 85% of usual and customary, though we can look at the language. We'll have to come back, look at the language, because I know that Ms. Yaden's going to have to have a chat or two, but I think the subcommittee can finish work on this.
Are you going from...
I'm going to 316,841, yeah.
You're going to both.
Well, because it doesn't make sense. To say, well, for inpatients, the state won't be the blame for the hospitals going out of business, but if they go out of business because of outpatient reimbursement. It just seems like if the state's going to take that policy for rural, we won't see ought to. Okay. Hearing no objection to Senator Hannon's motion, it's adopted. Then we had some rate increases in the hospital licenses that we did the other day when we did the health division budget that we need to amend. So the chair will move the Senate Bill 428 be amended to show those rate increases for licensing for the purposes of a trauma system be added to this bill. Hearing no objections, so order.
And I have those drafted, Mr. Chair.
And those are, okay, then I meant specifically in our dash 8 amendment? Or
dash
6. Dash 6 amendments, that's what my motion meant. Senator Hannon will move it even. The dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 428, so ordered. Then Senator Hannon moves it out to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with the understanding we might have to look at some of the language. It's out of subcommittee, because I don't hear any objections at all.
Thank you very much.
And then we're adjourned. We'll have to deal with the migrate issue tomorrow.
Public Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee meeting, May 26, 1987, 1:30 p.m.
room H-174. We'll come to order. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2870. Representative Brion. Welcome down here very often.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me this afternoon. Actually, in my stay here at the legislature since 1979, this is my first time in front of Ways and Means. I'm sure it will be a memorable experience. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have for you some written testimony. It's at Mr. Representative McCracken's right shoulder, some testimony right
Which
there.
Which one do you want handed out first? Yeah. Oh, from you?
Sure. And let me just summarize what the bill does. This last year, there was a culmination in the U.S. Congress, and the U.S. Congress passed the Immigration Reform Act of 1986. Mm-hmm. And to basically describe the law is to say the feds did it to us again. The feds enacted what they call employer sanctions, which requires every employer of new employees to have certain record requirements. A new employee must show at least two pieces of identification, a birth certificate, driver's license, something like that. This includes the city of Salem, includes the Oregon legislature, Safe Corporation, etc. This is very spendy for employers. At minimum, it's going to require somebody to spend extra time going through documentation, requires at least a file cabinet to keep the records for 2 or 3 years, and it's really going to put a damper on the Oregon comeback. What the bill does is allows the Employment Division of the State of Oregon to be a certifying agency under the Immigration Act. That means if a person who is a job applicant comes to the Employment Division, they can show the identification to the Employment Division. The Employment Division will then say, you are okay, and we will send you on a job referral. And this way, the employer is safe from the possible civil and criminal sanctions. And you know, this affects people who are small businesses. It really affects our agriculture. I've left for you I think it's yesterday's paper. What has this new immigration bill done to us? Well, people are afraid to come forth. We have a shortage of pickers. We have an early harvest this year, and most of the crops are going to rot on the trees or on the vine. We did have an amendment in the Labor Committee to allow the Employment Division to charge a potential employee up to $10 for a one-time application. Since the House hearing, some new information has come forward. There were other states like, I believe, Idaho and California, whose Employment Division does this already for free. They assume it's part of their state responsibility.
President Jones.
This that you're proposing the fee for here is something that the Employment Division is already doing with other prospective employees. This is a little unusual to propose a fee for a certain group of people. I guess that trying to understand the need for it, although I understand the situation with the new immigration law and all that. But go ahead. I just wanted to be sure that I'm on the right track here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jones, you're absolutely right, sir. One of the things that has come to our attention is under the new Immigration Reform Act, under Section 124, the Employment Division already has to check out the employment authorization of any alien who wants unemployment insurance. So theoretically, they have to do a similar type of function, run a similar type of computer program, and that's already one of the responsibilities because the unemployment funds are federal funds.
Is this it? Did you plan this to be an ongoing thing, or just to get these people set up?
It will be an ongoing thing. It should be a one-shot item for most people, and what we'll have to worry about is the youngsters, once they hit a working age, they will have to be certified.
I guess what I was thinking there, if you take care of the number of immigrants that there are, or have, whatever you want to call them, at one time, then that would take care of the big job now, and then they could be just like anybody else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, if the immigration bill only pertained to aliens or immigrants, that'd be one thing, but it pertains to every U.S. citizen, every worker in the United States.
See.
So we're talking about 120 million people.
Right. Yes, Senator Hannon.
Representative, you indicate that the Employment Division currently is doing this activity. Are they using federal funds to carry out this activity? And if they are currently carrying this activity out, if we were to place this in the statute, could they likewise be using federal funds to carry this activity out, rather than the state having to perhaps use employer funds, use federal funds to carry out this function, because they are serving as an extension of the feds in this particular instance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, as I understand it, all states have to verify through a program called SAFE, Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlement Programs, the eligibility for non-citizens for benefits under AFDC, Medicaid, unemployment compensation, food stamps, housing assistance, and higher education. That's just for certain aliens. What we envision is trying to expand this program to include all workers. The current SAFE program is 100% federally funded. There would be no federal funding to have this labor certifying process.
Well, the $3 to $4 million fiscal impact per biennium, is that for the extended verification, or is that for the entire program?
Senator Hannon, Mr. Chair, I think that was an initial ballpark figure, and that was given to me by Mr. Thorne of the Employment Division. We think that would be maybe this include the startup cost to drop some new computer programs, some new systems. But we think that, you know, after the first year or two, when everybody comes online, that the cost should be very marginal. It should be just new people entering the workforce, like youngsters and a few other miscellaneous groups.
Well, we'll have to quiz the division, I think, on some of these points. Now, what about this $10 fee? You don't propose that, do you, in any seriousness?
No, Mr. Chair.
So that's gone, right?
It's up to the...
That's gone.
Okay.
So then, we're left with a fee on employers. That might not be too good either.
Correct.
That's gone. So now, we're up to considering a diversion then from the UI fund.
That wouldn't be my first preference, Mr.
Chair. What would your first preference be?
Is somehow try to expand the current system under SAFE to include this program. If they're using the same hardware, maybe there could be simple modifications to the software to try to do the best they could with existing resources.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I can say is other states like Idaho and California are doing it within their existing budget.
I appreciate
your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Probably somebody else has signed up. Farm Bureau? There's other members in here. Did they want to testify on this?
Yeah,
The division wants to be involved. I know that. But I don't know about Representative Sobel. Maybe he's just watching. Did you want to testify?
I just walked in. I don't know what
building. Oh. We're doing Employment Division relating to the Federal Act. What's it called?
Veterinarians, checking out veterinarians.
That's it. That's the one. Immigration reform as well. Then we're going to do the river about, OK?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Don Schellenberg, Manager of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Seated with me is Bonnie Hahn, who is our INS reform specialist working with Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is here in support of House Bill 2870 as introduced. I would hasten to add at this point that we are opposed to the provision requiring the $10 fee. That would do nothing but drive the potential employees away from the Department of Employment. I guess I would say at this point, too, that we would certainly hope there would not be a fee for the employers in this, whether it be agriculture employers, machine employers, or any other kind of production employer. We think that also would tend to remove people from the system, from using the system. It is a jobs service program, emphasize the word service, and we would like to see it stay in that vein. In fact, it may be illegal under federal law to require the job service program to have a fee, since it's required that it be freely accessible. And I think with a fee, it somewhat detracts from that being freely accessible. The question really, and I missed the first part of Representative Bria's testimony. I assume he explained to you exactly what the purpose of the bill is and what we are trying to accomplish. The question really which arises is what is involved in this process. And I would say that there's not much more as far as the employment division is concerned. There's not much more involved than what they are now doing, but as far as the employer is concerned, it would be significantly an added responsibility and indeed a cost to the employer, and substantially more than what he is now doing.
Now, this federal act,
mm-hmm.
Does it say state shall provide for an employee verification agent, or is it permissive?
No, Mr. Chairman, the INS Act, if that's the one you're referring to, says that it is optional that the Department of Employment be a verifier. They have the choice as to whether or not they want to be. House Bill 2870 removes that option and makes it mandatory that the Department of Employment be a verifier.
Now, the Fed's going to send some money along to pay for that?
And not to my knowledge. They have not sent any along at this point. Representative Bria mentioned the SAVE program,
mm-hmm.
And what the federal law does specify is that they will provide 100% of the funds to develop that program. No money to administer it, but to develop it. And the thought was there, and we'd understood that Idaho was moving in this direction, that they were going to use the SAVE program, develop it. The federal would pay for the development of it. They would then expand it slightly more to include the certification process. I talked with Idaho today. They, in fact, are not going that route. They simply said, we recognized it as our responsibility to do this verification for the employers, and we are not making that a part of the SAVE program. We're doing it separate by itself, the verification.
And funding it, too, or just...
financing it, no cost to employer or employee. The same is true with California. I checked with them today as well. I'm checking with Washington. The initial response from Washington was the same, but I'm not able to verify that at this point.
Yeah, this bill's not going to be moving all that fast, so okay. You might check it out.
Okay, appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Again, with me is Bonnie Hahn, and I would like to have her describe for you currently what the Department of Employment does do that relates to verification process and how that might continue on into the certification of these employees.
Okay, thank you.
This is what is stipulated in the federal rules if the employment office chooses, in fact, to verify and authenticate. The first thing they need to do is that anything that they issue must be issued on an official agency letterhead. I think that one's pretty easy.
Mr. Chairman, if I might interrupt, I can let you follow along. I have some copies of that.
And it must also...
on the second page, highlighted.
...contain the seal, embossed seal of that agency. It must be addressed to the particular employing entity to which the individual is referred, to the new employer.
Well, that's done anyway. When they refer people out, they have that little referral card.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on number three now. It must certify, there must be certification that they have complied with the section of the law, and that's what it means to authenticate and verify, and that's pretty clear if you look back in the section of the law, what they need to look at to authenticate and to verify. Mm-hmm. Four, they must clearly stipulate any restrictions. And in most cases, that will be listed. If there are restrictions, it would be listed on the back of anybody's Social Security card at this point. That's a discussion anyway. Five, let's see, and then they would not be required themselves to re-verify, nor would the employer, if that is done, if it has been done once. Those are basically what's being required. Right. And then the I-9 form that you might want to look at.
Which is the first page.
Okay, which is your first page. This is the form that every employer in the United States is going to have to use, anyone hired after November 6. Okay. Now, they have made two changes, which I discovered today in Washington, D.C., but it's simply adding a few more documents that can be used. Pretty simple. Where the complication may come in is during the first year, the special agricultural workers can start applying to be accepted and qualify as of June 1 of this year. So between June 1 and November 30, 1988, when their applications may be accepted, that might be a complicated period. But as more and more individuals apply for their status to become legal, they will already have the documentation. So the requirements of what someone must verify will become less and less and less as time goes on.
Representative Jones.
But they can work in the meantime.
As long as they have already gone in for their first interview at INS, they will be issued a Social Security card and they will be allowed to work. Right.
So that does not complicate any crops right now.
Ask the question in a different way, perhaps.
With that, then they can go ahead and harvest all the crops that, for this season or work on those crops.
Well, they can start applying June 1 and however long that application takes. Crops are still in a great deal of jeopardy because our workers aren't here even to apply.
Well, but wait a minute now. We're already into crops.
Right.
In Eastern Oregon, thin and onions and right. Beets and plenty that, there are hundreds of them up there. And are they held up now? Can they work now?
There are two possibilities at this point. Workers right now who claim they qualify for the special agricultural worker program and who say they are going to apply can cite what's called the special rule. It means that if an employer has the I-9 and the employee cannot come up with the documentation in column C, you write special rule. But they're only protected until September 1. But that's for your crop, but not for everyone else's necessarily. So from now until September 1.
We have to go through September and October. Right?
Well, you're not protected for October if, in fact, the individual, and that would be part of the verification process, the individual would have to have this documentation. The point rather than the effect on the crop, which is important aside from this, is that as more and more workers complete their paperwork, they will already have the verification that they need to present to their employer or to the employment office in case they go from one job to another job. So there'll become less and less of a need to verify because they will have the information in front of them, if that is clear. Having worked with the employment office, I do know that I have already seen the form in which someone already states that they believe they're eligible to work in the United States. So that's being done. If you look at the top portion of the I-9, you'll see that that information is already taken in one form or another by the employment office. That's general information.
Right.
So what we're talking about is looking at some documentation and then checking blanks from our perspective.
And so you're arguing against a large fiscal impact.
Initially to set it up and have someone maybe put this or include maybe one more step on a form that they already have. So I would think that there must be some form.
They wouldn't have to change. They wouldn't have to use the I-9, the state. No.
No, they can do it. They can do an actual certification form.
Okay, Sarah Hannon.
Is the real intent behind this bill so as to remove the liability off the farmer who hires the person and put the onus upon the State Employment Division.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, that is a side effect of that. That's not necessarily our real intent. Our real intent is the efficiency of moving the worker out into the field as rapidly as possible, with the strawberries and other things going along by the wayside because of a lack of workers. Instead of having 500 workers show up at the strawberry field in the morning and then the employer having to go through this.
I think he said yes. Did you say yes, Senator Hannon?
Yes.
Well, I was just trying to follow up on Representative Jones' question that I think they're going to get into a crunch, possibly a crunch situation where they're going to have to hire individuals and they need this process. So if the state, the sooner the process was in place, the sooner the problems would be solved for the person who actually is going to have to do the hiring. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, that's correct.
But that only works if the employee comes through the division.
Right.
How many farm workers come through the division now?
How many might be coming through?
Well.
Not many, I assume.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Yes, I think you're correct. Probably not a whole lot do come through. I think with this change, more of them would come through. More of the agricultural producers, at least, if not other producers as well, would be then seeking the services of the State Department of Employment in getting their workers.
And that's why you think there isn't a fiscal impact?
No, Mr. Chairman. We aren't denying that there will be some fiscal impact. Not making that kind of case, that kind of denial. What we may be saying as far as fiscal impact is concerned is that we don't believe it would be as great as the $4 million or alleged $4 million that has been cited. And we think it's within, we would hope it's within the realm of the department to do that now, and if not, we would seek the legislature's support in moving the appropriate funds in to that department to accomplish what needs to be done.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The situation that I'm familiar with, and that is that you get a bunch of a group, I should say, of workers in this. Usually the employers, the farmers all deal with the crew boss, and they don't deal with individuals. Now, are they required to go through the employment office, those individuals? Because that's going to really complicate things up there, because the crew bosses have been there a long time. They speak English real well, and a lot of the others that come don't speak English. So you just get a crew boss and say, I want that field onions weeded there, and we'll pay you so much to do it, and they just go get the people to do it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, there is no requirement that anybody go through the Department of Employment. All this bill is saying that if someone does apply for work through the Department of Employment, that when the employer asks for a person to come out from the Department of Employment, that employer will know that that person has already been verified as legally able to work in the United States.
Chairman,
can I ask a question?
Sure.
How is this going to help farmers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, this would help farmers who apply for workers through the Department of Employment, so that when they come, then the farmer would not have to go through the verification process himself and hold up his operation or put on another crew member or whatever to take care of that work at that point. It would have already been done, and they would be able to move that worker right into the field.
So you think there are going to be a lot of farmers that are going to no longer want to hire illegals, non-documented. Is that what you think the effect of this new federal law is?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, they better not hire illegal workers, because they will be subject to sanctions, up to $10,000 penalty if they do. And
your being here today is a sign that you and your employer really think that federal law is going to work and have teeth and all that.
Mr. Chairman,
that's an education to me. I didn't know how this was all going to play out. There's so much confusion in the press about what's happening.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, that's correct.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Wires, I'd like to add that the contractors in the field, and also Representative Jones, can in fact verify if they wish, but it is still the employer who's going to be sanctioned. And that's very crucial. So the contractor can say whatever he or she wants and help authenticate and verify. However, that fine will still be placed against the employer. And when you look at a berry crop of 300 people perhaps per day, even 70 of those having already been verified by the employment office will save time, a crucial amount of time. Thank you.
Well, it sounds like a hell of a timely bill. It does, right when farmers are in a crunch.
Right, just what they need.
Well, they'll just tell people, we aren't going to hire anybody until you've gone and gotten that form filled out. They're going to let all the screening be done. Now, whether or not we can afford to shift that on to the taxpayers, but God, it's going to be a terrible thing for the farmers to. Much of my family operating on migratory. I've always been kind of impatient that this problem be solved. Now, if it's being solved,
Mr. Chairman, I would. I'd like to emphasize that this, of course, does not only apply to agriculture. This applies to every employer in the state, manufacturer, your legislature, your legislative assistants, et cetera, or anyone would hire from now on. This applies to.
How the feds keep this up, you know, we're just implant little plates in this. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I make one other comment, we would then also request, in order to make this bill as timely as possible, we would request that the committee amend this bill and change the effective date from January 1, 1988 to September 1, 1987. And I might have Bonnie explain the reason for that.
So September and October crops, right?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairperson, I think that the important point here is that the difficult portion related to this bill is the period between June 1 and November 30, 1988. After September 1, 1987, the workers will have their verification together to some extent. They're not going to be sitting there without any verification whatsoever. So the impact of the bill is going to be lessened as time goes on. But if we wait until after September, until January, a lot of the verification and authentication would already have taken place and will have impacted on our growing season, and I think made a big difference in the crop from this harvest season. So the